Council, as you're getting settled, I'll just call the next case. It's A240827 in the matter of the welfare of the child of ANW and ZCW parents. Council, you are familiar with our proceedings. You will each have 15 minutes for your primary argument. The appellant has an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use that. This matter is being recorded. That is the only recording that is permitted during today's proceedings. I'd ask that you state your name and identify your client before you begin speaking. And with that, counsel, whenever you're finished settling in, we are ready for you.
Your Honor, I think we are reversed.
Oh my gosh, I was respondent last time I was here. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Thank you for pointing that out.
Yeah, no problem.
Is this your water?
Nope.
Okay.
May it please the court and opposing counsel, my name is Mallory Stoll. I represent the appellant, ANW, mother in this appeal. ANW challenges the district court's order involuntarily terminating her parental rights to her daughter, MW. In my briefs, ANW challenges both the sufficiency of the evidence to support the three grounds for termination, as well as the district court's determination that termination of parental rights was in the best interest of MW. I intend to focus my remarks this morning on the grounds for termination, but will of course welcome any questions as to any issues raised in the briefs. The arguments raised by ANW in her briefs share a common thread. Ultimately, the district court's conclusions of law also reflect this. The issue in this case for this court to ultimately determine and consider is whether the injuries sustained by MW while in ANW's care, namely the bruising and the simple fracture that occurred to her right arm, coupled with ANW's denial that she intended to hurt MW or that she caused those injuries to MW, are sufficient to terminate her parental rights.
But that's not the only basis on which the district court relied for the termination proceeding. I mean, there were events that occurred after that the alleged incident giving rise to the concern about the health and safety of the child that the district court was also concerned about.
I'm taking that, Judge Frisch, to mean that you're referring to when the parents left the state of Minnesota, had the child
in violation of a court order.
In violation of the 72-hour hold at that time. But yes.
Court order. Yes. There was.
Well, it was a law enforcement hold at that time. So I would not agree that's a court order, but I agree it's a legal document, and I agree that the 72-hour hold, we're challenging the validity.
You know, when they did find the couple and the child in Kentucky, it did necessitate calling the SWAT team out.
Yep.
And there was a standoff for over an hour. I mean, it is proper for the district court to take those events into consideration as well. Would you agree?
I do agree, but I think the problem with that not being sufficient or why I would submit that that cannot or should not be a basis upon which the district court relied is we have two parents who both engaged in that conduct. One of their rights were terminated. One was not. And so that is why at the commencement of my remarks, I'm trying to focus on what was distinctive between the mother and the father. Certainly, I'm not here.
One thing appears to be the father, my words, not yours, got with the program and your client did not. So I think the district court was focusing on that the father sort of accepted responsibility, knew what he did was wrong, complied with the case plan, and your client, it appears, again, my words, not anyone else's, did not do those things. So isn't that a basis to distinguish between what happened to father's rights and what happened to your client's rights?
I respectfully disagree, Judge Conley, and here's why. If this court looks to the findings of fact, there are numerous references throughout that I know I cited in my brief, the paragraphs and the page numbers, that demonstrate that both parents were engaged with case planning to the extent they were able to while they were incarcerated for in excess of 1 year. I will do my best to find some of these specific page numbers and present them on rebuttal, but right away I turn to page 9 of the district court's order, talking about the fact that it was clear to both the agency and the guardian ad litem that the parents were engaged in planning a meeting with foster parents. Megan Beauvais, the ongoing case manager, there are findings of fact that the parents were engaged in safety planning, were meeting with the social worker, were receiving updates about their daughter. And so there.
I think the district court found that mother failed to create a safety plan. Are you challenging that finding?
Yes, Your Honor. And I did challenge that on. I have that argument in page 25 of my principal brief is the first place I see it.
And so how is that clearly erroneous? I mean, I read your brief. I just wanted to be clear on exactly what you're challenging in regards to that finding, because I think that's important in the district court's analysis.
Judge Cochran, so first, there are findings. There are essentially inconsistent findings in the district court's order. At one part of the paragraph of her order, excuse me, I do recall there was a reference to A&W not engaging in safety planning, but then later on in those same findings of fact, it says that the parents are engaged in safety planning. I think if this court looks to the testimony of Megan Beauvais as well, she fleshes that out further and does acknowledge, to the best of my memory with the voluminous transcripts in this matter, that both parents were engaging in safety planning, starting to create those safety networks, those supports, and plan for those next steps. Unfortunately, in this case, what we ultimately had that really inhibited both parents is they were in custody for more than 1 year, and then in the middle of trial, the same county who's asking to terminate their parental rights decides to dismiss the charges and release them from custody. It gave the parents just a couple of weeks to do what they could with the resources and supports they had to demonstrate they were fully committed to and willing to engage in services to demonstrate their ability and fitness as parents. As I acknowledge, Judge Frisch, we've talked about some of the admittedly difficult facts of this case that we have below. But what I really want to emphasize in my remarks is that, and let me go a step further with that. The district court itself called some of the parents' choices atrocious. Those are findings that A&W doesn't really have a legal basis to challenge on appeal, but what the Supreme Court has said in MDO is that a parent may not be the picture of a model parent, but few children would be reared by natural parents if model parents were the standard. I'm not saying the facts of this case are things we see rampant throughout the state of Minnesota, but I cite that for the proposition that child protection cases innately have problems within the family system that need to be corrected. And when you look at the agency's testimony, specifically Ms. Beauvais, with regard to the reasons the agency was seeking termination of parental rights, it really was grounded in the injuries that MW sustained, both the bruise from the December 24th incident as well as the bruising, I believe abrasion, and simple fracture of her right arm that occurred on or about January 11th of 2023. That's despite the fact that the agency never asked to be relieved of reunification efforts. Now, they weren't required to make those efforts, and the district court never made the finding of fact, or excuse me, made a determination that reasonable efforts would be futile. I offer that because if the agency's position is fundamentally grounded in what happened more than a year before trial, what would have been the point in even trying to provide reasonable efforts or not being asked to be relieved of those efforts? So when we have cases where there are very unfortunate circumstances, where we have a 7-week-old child that had injuries that A&W doesn't challenge occurred while the child was in her care, that alone, yes.
Isn't the salient distinction, at least identified by the district court, that in both father and mother's participation in the case plan, father acknowledged that the injuries sustained by the child were non-accidental, and mother did not?
I do believe that is, in substance, what the district court's findings were.
And isn't that enough of a distinction to support the district court's determination that father's rights should not be terminated, but mother's should, in conjunction with the other information? But that is a salient distinction between in the findings by the district court.
Respectfully, no, Your Honor. And just hitting the high point reasons first, I think that the MDO case is instructive on that point, where we had a mother who had been convicted of second-degree unintentional murder towards her adopted daughter, and they sought termination of the rights of her biological child. The district court denied the petition, the Court of Appeals reversed, and then the Supreme Court reversed the Court of Appeals. MDO is cited extensively. I know in my principal brief, I am sure it is at least mentioned in my reply brief as well. But if we look at to the MDO case, that provides that accepting responsibility is not required to defeat is not sufficient to determine that there's egregious harm. And so, put another way, I would also go to just the language of the statute, the ground for termination for what is oftentimes referred to as the egregious harm ground, but it requires more than a showing of egregious harm. It requires not only an injury, but also that demonstrates a grossly inadequate ability to parent, and also it has to be of the nature, duration, and chronicity such that any child should not be in the care of that parent. And so the sum and substance of ANW's argument as to the egregious harm ground, and I did my very best in my research to be as exhaustive as I could to find what cases have we found has an egregious harm determination been affirmed. None of the facts of those cases are similar and are readily distinguishable, are far more severe and significant than the facts of this case.
I mean, it's a little bit different here because the district court, as I read its determination, is concerned with providing an environment where the parents are aware of safety considerations that impact the child. And when I read paragraph 134, it indicates that the district court seems to be indicating to me that father is acknowledging that the child was placed in a situation or was in a situation where it suffered non-accidental injuries. But mother did not acknowledge that the child's surrounding environment. I'm not talking about acceptance of her personal responsibility. This is a different issue. I don't think the district court is requiring her to take personal responsibility for inflicting the injuries upon the child. I think that the district court is indicating that mother was unwilling to acknowledge that the circumstances under which the child became injured were non-accidental. And that's, I think, the salient distinction here, and perhaps a salient distinction with the MO case. How do you want to address that?
So,
do you understand my question?
I do, Judge Frisch. So MDO I do think is pretty factually similar in terms of a parent denying personal responsibility, but going to then your question. If you look at the transcript, specifically the testimony of ANW, she doesn't deny that injuries occurred. She didn't try to cover it up. She doesn't deny that having her child with, from December, the bruise on the on her face or the or her simple fracture on her right arm. She doesn't say any of that is good, appropriate, or acceptable in any way, shape, or form. I would submit that is precisely why, as soon as the parents realized that things weren't right, they did what any reasonable parent would do. And if we look
at the child in a car seat with a broken arm and drive 15 hours to Kentucky.
That absolutely was not, and to use the quote I said before, that was an atrocious parenting choice by both of the parents. But that
but
does
I mean,
not
isn't the main difference, as Judge Fish is highlighting, on in MDO, when mom got out, she complied with the case plan. And here the district court takes great pains to point out that your client was not complying or understood the need for safety plans. I mean, isn't that alone the big distinction between that case where the Supreme Court reversed a TPR decision and this case where you are asking us to do the same thing?
Respectfully, no, Judge Conley, because in the 3 weeks, as I pointed out, and I will find those additional paragraphs to support this, the court determined that following her release from custody, so in MDO, I believe that the parent was actually in custody and in prison because I think her prison sentence was in excess of 100 months. There was very limited programming in the jail that's well supported by the record. And once she was released, she took the steps that she could in that short amount of time to demonstrate her willingness and ability to engage. What the district court did say throughout its decision is that ANW did not accept responsibility or accountability for it. And I think that that runs into the MDO problem we have here, where that alone.
Well, I mean, I think the district court said more than that. I mean, I think the district court also finds your client lacking in credibility. I mean, the district court just didn't say she doesn't get it. The district court gave concrete reasons to support its decision, and that she was never going to get it.
I do see my time is up. Judge Frisch, may I answer?
Yes, please answer Judge Connolly's question.
So I do think that is that exactly what the district court said was because she didn't accept responsibility, there was never going to be a point in time where she would be comfortable, the judge I'm referring to, working towards reunification or denying the TPR petition. That is, and talking about those credibility determinations, yes, there were certain times, particularly when the evidence or testimony presented contradicted one another or was inconsistent with one another, the court did determine that ANW's version was not credible. But the district court didn't find that ANW was 100% incredible. It was for very specific findings of fact that was in there. And finally, Judge Conley, I just wanted to also say, if I didn't say this already, the fact that the judge did find that both parents were complying with their case plan and in full compliance with their case plan, particularly once they were released. And Ms. Beauvais also testified, and the district court found that the services and components of their case plan they weren't engaging in were simply not available in jail. I will see you on rebuttal.
Yes, thank you very much, counsel. Anytime you're ready, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Elizabeth Johnson. I am the attorney for Scott County Human Services. I'd just like to first start with Ms. Stoll did talk a little bit about there were some comments in the court's decision where the court acknowledged that after the individuals were out of custody, that they began the safety plan. Those would be on pages 9 and 35 of the district court's decision. Your Honors, I do address this in my brief that, one, the court, I don't interpret what the court's doing there as saying the court is finding that they are safety planning. But even putting that aside, I think the bigger issue that is readily apparent in the court's decision that the district court found several times is that the judge did not believe that appellant could ever successfully safety plan. And the reason
and
for...
And what is that based on? I mean, to be fair, and I think Ms. Stoll mentioned this in her brief and in the argument, both mom and dad were in custody for the better part of the time period during which the safety plan was in place, and they had a limited ability to do the things that the district court wanted them to do. And so to what extent is it fair? I mean, how long were they out of custody before the trial? I mean, or it was in the middle of trial when they were let out.
That is correct. I believe it was about 3 weeks.
I mean, so we're talking about a three-week period of time to assess the ability of both mom and dad to parent, and I'm concerned that that may not be enough time.
And I understand the court's concern, but what the court needs to remember is that there were attempts to safety plan while they were in custody. During Ms. Bovis's testimony, and this, Your Honor, would be in transcript volume 4, page 49, Ms. Bovis talked about the fact that there's an ability to safety plan without accepting responsibility. I will get into why that's important in this case, but there are ways to safety plan without accepting responsibility, and the appellant in this case absolutely refused to do that. They couldn't do that simple thing of, okay, how can we move forward even if we're not going to admit that she did something wrong? But, Your Honor...
Didn't the district court find in paragraph 114 that the agency cannot safety plan and address these frustrations and or stressors because mother has refused to be open and honest about life?
Yes. Yeah. I do agree that her inability to accept responsibility is important. But what I'm saying is even beyond that, the agency attempted to work with appellant to get her to safety plan without accepting responsibility, and she simply didn't do it. Going on to that...
What were the components of the safety plan? What was she supposed to have done?
Recognize stressors, identify people in her life that could help with caring for the child if she gets overworked. And I recognize the fact that while she's in custody, she can't actually do those things, but she could have at least verbalized them, which she absolutely refused to do. And then, Your Honors, so going to the 3 weeks, yep, they began a safety plan. But as the court could see from the trial, even during the trial, A&W was absolutely refusing to admit that there's a non-accidental reason for this child's injuries. I lay this out in my brief that throughout the entire case, A&W, and this is a distinction between A&W and father, A&W was adamant that there was some kind of medical reason for the child's injury. But what makes it so incredible and what shows why she's hiding her responsibility is she kept moving the ball. First, it was that, oh, we have osteoporosis and mystery bruises. Then it was osteoporosis and brittle bones. Then it was hyperparathyroidism. Then it was Ehlers-Danlos. I'm saying that wrong, but the fourth type of medical condition, all of which were refuted by the time of trial, but she was still adamant that it must be this hyperparathyroidism or this Ehlers disease. Even though she admitted that it happened in her care, she didn't admit that it was a non-accidental issue. And, Your Honor, I think that's important to show that... we can't trust her with this child if she can't admit that there's something happened in the environment, even if it wasn't her, something happened in the environment that wasn't a medical condition to injure this child.
Tell me what the county did to work with mom after she was released from custody to help her understand that the child's injuries were non-accidental.
I can't point to anything in the record, Your Honor, about
that.
Isn't
that a failure of reasonable efforts by the county then?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor, because
what did the county do to help her understand that the nature of the danger that the child was in was non-accidental?
I would say, Your Honor, that the steps that the agency took to try and negate every single medical condition that she threw out there was them trying to show her, like, look, this, there's not a medical reason for this.
So there's a difference between debunking non-medical reasons and assisting a parent in understanding that the nature of the injuries were affirmatively that those injuries occurred while in the care of the parent. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I'm trying to figure out is, was the safety plan targeted at the concern that the district court identified, which was the reason for the termination of her parental rights?
And I can't speak to specifics, Your Honor, as to what they talked about in those that was not in the record. Your Honor, one other thing I wanted to touch on is that Ms. Stoll indicated that there wasn't any case law out there of a similar nature where egregious harm was discovered. And I actually have to thank Ms. Stoll for this one. Matter of Welfare of JMK, this is an unpublished decision, but 2017 Westlaw 3687812. In that situation, Your Honor, the injuries to an infant, and I don't know the exact age of the infant, but based on reading the opinion, we're talking to a child under the age of one, was at daycare one day, and then the next day came back to daycare full of bruises. That was one incidence of abuse. It also qualified under the statute as egregious harm because it's multiple bruises to an infant. And I know the court can see from our briefs that Ms. Stoll and I are having a bit of a dispute over what's exactly required for the egregious harm statute. They don't address this grossly inability to parent in this case. They also found this one incidence of abuse was enough to have egregious harm, the statutory basis for termination, be found. So here's a case where there's no broken bones. There's bruises, no broken bones. It's enough for egregious harm. It's enough for termination. So to say that there's no case law out there that supports this case being enough for egregious harm, that's just simply not true.
Can you address appellant's argument regarding MDO?
One second, Your Honor. Your Honor, I apologize that I don't recall the facts of MDO sufficient enough to argue against that. It's a failure on my part.
Well, isn't one difference, the Supreme Court and MDO seem to focus on whether there was or not evidence of a consistent pattern of abuse, and here we have two instances.
Yes.
The mug.
Yes.
And then the
Well, yes, Your Honor, that is correct. So in this instance, we have two instance of abuse, as well as, Your Honor, I would note that case is from 1990. There's been plenty of case law since then that has elaborated on egregious harm. If Your Honor's like, I can go into why I think appellant is wrong regarding the addition of another requirement to the egregious harm statutory basis for termination. Left it over here. The appellant believes that for the egregious harm statutory basis to be found, the court needs to have found that there was egregious harm in the parent's care, that it was a grossly inadequate, shows a grossly inadequate ability to parent, and then in addition, that it is of a nature, duration, or chronicity that indicates a lack of regard. And I do want to call out, during her oral argument just now, Ms. Stoll indicated that it's nature, duration, and chronicity. That is not the requirement. It's an or. Any one of those would be sufficient. Where we get into the dispute, Your Honor, over the standard is whether or not it's required in every case to show a grossly inadequate ability to provide minimally adequate parental care. That language, Your Honor, is not in the statutory basis for the egregious harm termination, but is in the definition of egregious harm, which is in 260C.007, subdivision 14. But when the court looks at that section, yes, that is the definition of egregious harm, but then it goes on further to say that egregious harm includes and then lists a whole bunch of different crimes. Case law, I think, makes it very clear that if something falls under one of those definitions of crime, there's not this additional requirement to also find that it demonstrates a grossly inadequate ability to provide minimally adequate parental care. I cite in my brief where that distinction is done in the TJJ case. And, Your Honor, so in this case, that's not what the court should be looking at as to whether or not that was shown here. It doesn't need to be shown here. And, Your Honors, one of the other things that appellant in their principal brief talks about is that when deciding whether egregious harm happened in this case, the courts should only be focusing on what happened on January 11th and January 12th, which is the date of the broken arm and the bruises. We dispute over whether or not the injury in December qualifies as egregious harm. The district court did not make that finding, but I do believe, make that legal finding, but they made all the factual findings that would allow the court to find that that was also egregious harm. But even putting that aside, I don't believe that what Ms. Stoll is arguing, that the court can only look at January 11th and January 12th, is in line with the statute. I don't think it's in line with the consideration of the paramount consideration of the child protection statutes, which is that the child's health, safety, and well-being, best interests, are the paramount consideration. It's not within the paramount consideration of the, it's not within the health, welfare, and safety of a child to say we'll only look at this bigger injury because the other ones are more minor. That's not in the safety of the child to say we're only going to look at the big injury, even though this child has been intentionally injured before. We're not going to look at that to determine whether or not it's safe to put this child back with the person who abused them. And that's what the court found here, Your Honors, is that A&W was the one to have abused the child. And that's why it's in the child's best interest not to return her to the appellant. Your Honor, and then going into the best interests of the child, the district court did make the finding that there's an interest in the child maintaining a relationship with her parent. Parent obviously has an interest in staying with her child, but that the paramount consideration here, which is the safety of the child, would not be served by keeping the parental relationship. I see I'm running out of time. If anyone has any additional questions.
It does not appear so. Thank you, counsel. Thank you very much. Yep. Ms. Stoll, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it.
Thank you. I do have 5 points I hope to make on rebuttal.
First, Judge Connolly, you asked about the findings and what the district court determined with regard to compliance with case plan and safety planning. The ones I was able to find, paragraphs 115, 116, 137, and 152, I believe will provide, confirm what I have submitted this morning, that both parents were in compliance with their case plan to the best of their ability.
Counsel, can you just clarify for me, and I didn't see this in your brief, I may have missed it. You are not claiming that the county failed to engage in reasonable efforts, are you?
I did not make that explicit argument in my brief, no.
Great, thank you.
Next, respondent talks about reasons for, or what the components of the safety plan were. She indicated stressors and people in her life. A&W did acknowledge that there were stressors, and in fact, that there would be a transition period that would be necessary to ensure that the child's best interest is the paramount consideration. That's paragraph 148 of the findings of fact. She also said the safety plan included identifying people in her life. A&W did. Father, maternal and paternal relatives, even the foster parents were going to be meeting with the parents to talk about the child, what that transition would look like, what her needs are, et cetera. Third, Your Honors, respondent once again really highlights and talks about the need from the district court standpoint that A&W needed to be open and honest. Basically another term for wanting her to admit that she's the one that did this. I do want to point out that...
Do you disagree that the medical evidence presented and accepted by the district court is sufficient to show this was not an accident, that I'm not talking about the coffee mug, the second one, is sufficient to show that this was not accidental?
Your Honor, I do know that the district court did, found it was non-accidental.
Right, but my question is, do you agree that the medical testimony supported that finding? And if you don't disagree, explain to me how the medical evidence did not. Because, I mean, I thought several doctors were saying, you know, it could not have happened the way your client indicated it could have happened. You know, 7-week-old children just don't kind of break their arms accidentally. Now, does the medical evidence support that?
So we had several medical...
One doctor...
I'm not talking about...
You.
I'm sorry.
The others didn't, and the district court is allowed to pick and choose. So does the medical evidence support this was not a non-accidental injury?
And Judge Conley, I was going to jump right into Dr. George, who was called by the agency. I wasn't going to talk about the witness that was called by the father. But what Dr. George testified to, I mean, when we look at the diagnosis of child abuse, it's a rule out diagnosis. It's not a, we know this is what happened. And so what I recall from Dr. George's testimony, reviewing the transcripts preparing for today, is she acknowledged the possibility that it was, that the injury was accidental. Now, she also tested
her conclusion.
Her conclusion was that it was, that was a diagnosis of, I know there's a third word, it was a diagnosis or an impression consistent with child abuse. I'm mucking up the exact terms, but I acknowledge that's a finding. And
well, then
yeah,
I'm at a loss to understand then how the state has failed to meet their burden on egregious harm, according to you. How have they blown it?
So I would ask that you look at, since I'm running out of time, I think my reply brief, both briefs get into that, but really the reply brief next, it's not just a determination that there was egregious harm. That's not what the ground of termination is. It requires more than a determination of egregious harm. And looking at my reply brief, I talk about how if this court were to adopt the respondent's interpretation of what is required, the results would be frankly absurd with the number of cases that would be caught by that net of egregious harm and carry those very significant consequences for parents for even potentially accidental injuries. I see I'm out of time. May I make one final sentence?
One time, counsel.
Okay.
Very briefly. Yep.
Oh, thank
Very
you.
Very briefly.
Yes. With the egregious harm, all I wanted to say is page 18 and 19 of my principal brief. I talk about that the final part of that ground is an issue of first impression, and the court could certainly elaborate on that, as the Supreme Court declined to do. Thank okay. you.
Very good. Thank you very much, counsel. Thank you very both of you for your submissions. We appreciate them, and we will issue a opinion within the statutory time period. Thank you. And we are ready for our next case.